I would like to encourage any questions or comments if they come along. First, let's discuss why we actually need something like TCSA, which is yet another scheme in quantum field theory. It has to do with weak and strong coupling. If you take some Lagrangian, typically it has some kinetic terms and also some interaction terms multiplied by some couplings G. Then if you're interested in low-energy physics, well, if at least one of the operators becomes relevant, then these couplings become larger and larger at low energies, and at some scale, they become of order one, so perturbation theory breaks down. This is a very generic problem, of course, in field theory, and it's not easy to avoid, so the only way to get around this problem is if you have extra symmetries, like supersymmetry, or if you're working with an integrable model. But if that's not the case, then you're really in a bad shape, so you typically want to resort to some numerical method, and the most commonly known one is the lattice. So I assume people have at least some familiarity with the lattice, but what you do in that case is that you simulate the theory. So you don't do a computation directly using the Lagrangian, but you put a Lagrangian on a computer. You acquire a lot of statistics, so this can be tens of thousands or even hundreds of millions of CPU hours, and in the end you end up with estimates for the observables you're interested in with some error bars. But it has some downsides, so it's a very slow option. It takes you a huge amount of computer time, and always doesn't always work. So, for example, the lattice doesn't work well with chiral symmetry, with supersymmetry. So it seems very clear to me that there's a lot of space for thinking about alternative ways to do strong coupling computations. And to give a physics example of why this would be useful, the most interesting theory is then Yang-Mills theory, or non-abelian gauge theory in 4 or 3 dimensions with some gauge group, say, SUN, and you can add some massless fermions. These are the only two parameters. Then, of course, the phase structure of the theory depends only on NC and NF, but even the most basic question, say, is the theory gapless or gapped, is not easy to answer unless you have supersymmetry. So what's realized in nature is that if NF is very low, then the theory will be confining, and there will be a spectrum of glue ball and hadron states. But if NF is slightly larger, then you expect the theory to flow to some conformal field theory that can either be strongly coupled or weakly coupled. And if NF is very large, then asymptotic freedom is lost. But again, if you don't have supersymmetry, then it's absolutely very difficult, even on the lattice, to answer these questions, either numerically or even to find the value of NF for which conformal symmetry is broken. So this is an example that shows both that there are fundamental questions, so thinking about the landscape of RG flows, but also practical questions in the sense that given some values of NC and NF, what is the spectrum of the theory, or what does the CFT living in the IR look like? Well, now let me discuss this TCSA, the scheme itself, and especially the role of conformal field theory. So I already showed that if you go to low energies, then the couplings become large and computations become difficult. But on the other side, if you go to very high energies, the couplings become small and even vanish. And in that case, there's a symmetry enhancement. So the symmetry group of your field theory will not just be Poincaré, but Poincaré plus dilatation. So since there are no dimensional parameters, this is what you expect. And actually, generically, you don't just get rescalings, but you get a full conformal group at high energies. And in that case, you want to think of the RG flow as a breaking of this conformal symmetry. So you really need to think of a short distance theory, which is conformally invariant. You break this by adding some relevant operators, and the couplings become larger and larger at low energies. And let me also stress that in many cases, especially if you think about Lagrangian theories, then this UV theory will be free, for example, in the case of Yang-Mills, but it's not necessarily so. You can also start from some strongly coupled theory, say the tricritical easing model, add some relevant perturbation, then you also initiate some RG flow. But there, the UV theory score, of course, is definitely not free. Okay, so this is a way of thinking about the problem, but it's still far from clear whether you can use this to actually devise some scheme that's better than perturbation theory. And one way to do it is, well, you're interested in getting some RG flow, studying an RG flow, so you need some reference scale. But in a CFT, if you're working in flat space, these scales are completely absent. So that's something you need to work around. One way is that because you have this conformal symmetry, you can actually pass from flat space to some other geometry you like. And since you need to introduce a scale, this will be some compact space. So from the point of view of a CFT, the most natural choice will be to put it on a d-dimensional cylinder, by which I mean a time direction. And in every time slice of the cylinder will be a sphere of d minus one dimensions. And the sphere can have some arbitrary radius r. OK. And if you impose conformal invariance, then you'll get a specific relationship between the time on the cylinder and the radius r in flat space. So this tells you in a way that, well, the log is growing. So if time increases on the cylinder, this means that the radius in flat space also becomes larger and larger. So time translations on the cylinder correspond to dilatations in flat space. And actually, this is something that's well known to people who've studied some string theory, at least. So this idea that you can quantize a CFT on a cylinder. And you can turn it into something very concrete. So a CFT, the actors of a CFT are local operators O. So you can think of these, even if you're not familiar with conformal field theory, as some renormalized composite operators. There's a small theorem that tells you that the full Hilbert space of a CFT quantized on the cylinder is given by these operators inserted at t equals minus infinity, so at the low end of your cylinder. But you can say something more about the Hilbert space of a theory. So every operator has a quantum number called the scaling dimension, which tells you how the operator transforms under rescalings. So this is the transformation law of the CFT. And again, using the intuition we saw before, so time translations on the cylinder correspond to dilatations on the plane, it's not so difficult to argue that the Hamiltonian, or the generator of time translations on the cylinder, just gives you the scaling dimension of an operator O. So a state that's generated by an operator O has the energy delta if you put it on the cylinder. You also need some more intuition about what this Hilbert space looks like, because we actually use it in practice. So there are very few states with a low scaling dimension of, say, 1 or 10. But if you increase the energy or the scaling dimension on the cylinder, then the density of states is exponentially large. And also, of course, the full Hilbert space of a CFT is infinite dimensional. So that works for a normal CFT. But in a normal CFT, you don't gain much by putting it on a cylinder. But we're interested in working with RG flow, so with interacting theories. So how does it work in this case? Well, you can start with a Lagrangian where you add some interaction terms. Here are very general ones called O. And you can not a very difficult exercise to see how this maps to a Hamiltonian. So if we have just a pure CFT, then the Hamiltonian of the theory on the cylinder is given by the first term. But if you add such an interaction term, then there's a very simple prescription that tells you that the term you need to add to your Hamiltonian on the cylinder is given by this operator that's integrated over a time slice. And you have a coupling G that will be dimensionful if it's a relevant operator. And again, there's a prescription that tells you that this dimensionful operator gets mapped to a dimensionless coupling G multiplied by a power of the radius that makes its coupling dimensionless. And the notation is quite suggestive, I think. So there's some Hamiltonian with a part HCFT that acts diagonally, that acts very simply in a basis of conformal operators. And here there's an operator O integrated over a sphere that can act, well, in a more complicated way. And this thing, well, this makes us think of quantum mechanics, where this is some potential term with matrix elements that are given by the integral over a sphere, where these states I and J are these composite operators that are inserted at t equals minus infinity on the cylinder and t equals plus infinity on the cylinder. Again, now we can ask what happens if we take the radius to be very small. These dimensionless couplings G times R to some power are also very small, because this d minus delta is positive, since it's a relevant operator. So in that case, we can treat this as a small perturbation, and we can do old-fashioned or quantum mechanical perturbation theory, actually conformal perturbation theory, since you're perturbing away from a CFT. But that's not a very viable strategy, because we want to be doing strongly coupled physics. So you need to still devise some idea on how you can exploit the CFT structure to learn something about strongly coupled physics. And that's precisely the proposal of Yurov and Zamolochikov in 1989. They say, look, we're interested in the low energy physics of some RG flow. So what can we do? Well, working in the full Hilbert space seems like a very difficult problem, because then you need information about all the states in the theory, and you don't always have access to this analytically. So one reasonable assumption, a physical assumption, is just to work with low energy states in the UV CFT and to assume that if you throw away state with very high energy in the UV CFT, then you don't lose much if you want to look at states at lower scales in the RG flow. So to be concrete, you pick some maximal scaling dimension, say 10 or 15 or 20, and you keep only those states in your UV CFT, the scaling dimension lower than this delta max. And all other states, well, at least as a first approximation, you don't even think about them. Physically, this looks very much like having a UV cutoff. So if you have such a truncation in your CFT in place, then you cannot reproduce physics at energies higher than lambda UV, which would be delta max divided by the radius of your cylinder. Or otherwise, you could say that if you're studying correlation functions, then you cannot reproduce them at distances shorter than the inverse of the scale. But otherwise, like if you think about this in terms of effective field theories, then physics at energies much lower than this lambda UV should in principle be okay to calculate. They should not be very sensitive to these high dimension states. Although, of course, we will need to make this precise what follows. And also, you can give a very rough estimate of why this is better than perturbation theory. Well, perturbation theory generically would have a cutoff scale 1 over R. So if you can make this, if you can choose the scaling dimension where you cut off at of order 10 or 20, then you can do parametrically better than perturbation theory. And also, having such a cutoff in place gives us a concrete recipe for doing calculations. So suddenly you're working in a finite dimensional Hilbert space because, well, you're keeping only a finite number of states. So now you have the perspective of actually calculating this Hamiltonian. So at least the free part should be easy to do. So suppose you can write down the full Hamiltonian, then there is a perspective of actually doing the calculations on a computer. And some observables, sorry?
So is this rigorous in two dimensions? So say you have some interacting CFT in the UV, and you flow to some IR CFT, and due to this truncation per dimension, whatever, has this been shown to
converge?
Converge in two dimensions.
Yeah. So I will come like in a couple of slides. We will discuss this issue of convergence more closely. I think in some theories where some theories are finite with respect to this truncation method, and then you can rigorously show that this method converges. For other theories, you need to add some theories can diverge with this trunk regulator. Then you need to add some large counter terms. But still, it's possible, I think, to show that this scheme converges if you take the cutoff to infinity.
You'll give some criterion to distinguish these two classes?
Or yeah, but it's
try and error.
Well, it's not try and error, but it's theory dependent. So it depends on the CFT data. So it's not very, there's not one clear criterion which tells you when it will be completely finite or not.
You think of R as the normalization scale, right?
Yes.
So if you keep delta max fixed, this cutoff progressively decreases.
So
you have to increase delta max? Or
no, okay. This is a feature, not a feature. It's an aspect of the scheme in the sense that the infinite volume limit is difficult. So even if you take this cutoff dimension to be very high, at some point, at some point the truncation effects become important, so you cannot take the infinite volume limit naively. You will just get large truncation effects. So that's something you also see in what follows. So in practice, there will be some maximal radius R where the scheme makes sense, given your cutoff.
Sure.
And I was saying, so some observables like the spectrum are very easy to extract in the scheme, and other observables you need to think a bit more about how you want to calculate them. Suppose you're very motivated to do this TCSA yourself, then just a recap of what you need. So you need to pick some UV CFT, and you need to know the low energy, a list of all operators in your low energy Hilbert space. And also you need to know a finite number of free point functions. This is what you need for these interaction terms in the Hamiltonian. So again, these are part of the definition of your UV CFT. So there, if you know the CFT you're starting with, then these are just things you know already. So there's no need to do loop calculations or something complicated as input for your calculation. So in principle, we're good to go. And as a first example to give you a feeling of how this TCSA works, I'd like to start with a solvable theory, so the massive boson, which I hope most of us have seen at some point in our lives. It has a feature, of course, that if you take the mass term to be zero, then just the massless boson by itself is a conformal field theory, and it has a Z2 symmetry. So if there's a global symmetry, then TCSA will respect this symmetry, and you can do the calculation in every sector separately. So this is what we'll do in what follows. Of course, the massive boson is solvable, so we can compare the spectrum on the cylinder to the TCSA results, and we can also calculate the Casimir energy on the cylinder. Again, as an observable, we can match with. There's a feature that, of course, the massive boson is something you can study in any number of dimensions. So, there's a hard limit in the sense that you cannot take the number of space-time dimensions to 2, because the scaling dimension of a boson in d dimensions is d minus 2 over 2. So it goes to 0 if you go to 2 dimensions, and the spectrum of the theory collapses. So then the idea that if you have a cutoff in place, you want to end up with a finite Hilbert space, it doesn't work anymore. So you need to have a finite, to have a discrete spectrum, you need to be away from 2 dimensions. So again, when you do the calculation, you keep d as some parameter along the way, and in the very end, when you do the numerics, you set d to the space-time dimension you're interested in. And this way, you can have more cross-checks on see what you're doing is correct. You can construct the Hilbert space in a very algorithmic way, so it doesn't require a lot of thinking. All composite operators in the theory are just built out of phi and out of derivatives d mu, so you can start with a vacuum in the CFT, then you have states like phi, phi squared, phi cubed, etc. You can have more complicated composite operators like phi squared, d mu phi, d mu phi. But you can just make a list of all of these operators up to some dimension you choose, say 15 or 18 in the plots I'll show you. And of course, you need to take into account that there's an equation of motion. So if there are two operators that are equivalent up to this equation of motion, then they'll be the same state. So you don't need to add both states in the theory. And we'll also only regard the scalar sector, so state with total angular momentum 0. And then, of course, you need to write down the Hamiltonian. So the CFT part of the Hamiltonian is very simple. For these potential terms, these interaction terms, it's not difficult either. So you need to calculate, for example, integrals of three-point functions in the CFT of some composite operator here, some composite operator there. And you insert phi squared in the middle. So again, this is an algorithmic problem, and the only thing you need is Wick's theorem. So then if you do this exercise, you have a full Hamiltonian, which is just a large matrix. The coupling depends on the radius as m squared r squared, so it becomes larger and larger if you go to the IR. And you can extract the spectrum. And just to manage the expectations, what do you expect of the spectrum? Well, if you take the radius to be very small, then you're close to the UV, so you should just be sensitive to the CFT part, so the spectrum should be delta over this radius. But if you take the radius to be large, then both terms should be equally important, and you should really read off the mass spectrum. So you expect that the spectrum asymptotes if you go to large radius. And in between, there will be some crossover phenomenon. So this is what you get. I've plotted here for three space-time dimensions, both the Z2 even sector on the left and the Z2 odd sector. On the y-axis, you find the energy, and I've subtracted here the Casimir energy, so the vacuum has energy 0 in this plot, and on the x-axis, you see the radius of the cylinder. So let's, to be very concrete, take the one particle state, so that's this one, in the Z2 odd sector. You see that the TCSA results, which are the blue dots, they agree very well with the exact results, which are the red lines, so this line. And just to guide the eye, the TCSA results are joined by a blue line. So this blue line is not physical, but it's just there to guide the eye. And you see that, up to, say, radius 3, the agreement between TCSA and this exact result is very well. So it's the error here is on the order of several percent. And it starts becoming larger and larger if you go to larger radius. And this is also in line with what you asked before. So you see that this is, for example, a three-particle state, and here you see definitely that at large radius, the truncation effects become large. And in fact, this gray area corresponds to the naively what you think of as the sliding scale. So lambda UV, delta max divided by the radius. So this is really the naive cutoff you expect. So you see that if you're far away from this UV cutoff, then the results are good agreeing with what you like. And just to talk a bit more about the physics, here, for example, you can look at the two-particle sector. You see that there's not just one state, but there's actually a whole tower of excitations. These correspond to, the lowest one is just a two-particle state at rest, but these higher states correspond to boosted states. So there are two-particle states where there's momentum on the sphere such that the total momentum is still zero. And I didn't plot the Casimir energy, but you find results with the same precision. So again, it's percent level all the way up to radius 3.
So that includes the mass correction?
Which mass correction?
The Casimir energy also has some dependence on the mass.
Well, it depends on the mass only through this parameter MR.
Correct.
So that's precisely. You, it's not a constant. It's really a function of the radius or of the mass. Yeah. So I think it's now time to talk a bit about the truncation effects and how this can be put on a more solid footing. It's useful to think of the full Hilbert space as a sum of the low energy states that we're taking into account in this TCSA and some high energy states that were not explicitly taken into account. And if you work in such a basis, then the Hamiltonian also, it consists of a low energy part, LL, low, which we have. This is the matrix we're using in TCSA. And also some matrix elements that involve high energy states, which we're not explicitly taking into account. So if you're being very naive, like what we did before, then you're just solving a Schrödinger equation of the form H low acting on a state equals energy of the same state. So this is like what I call bare TCSA. It's not renormalized. But if you do it like this, then you don't know precisely what the truncation effects are. So the only way you can see if you're in good shape or not is by varying the cutoff and seeing if the results vary much or a lot or not. But actually, you can be more precise and you can derive an exact Schrödinger equation for the low energy states. So it looks a lot like the bare equation, but there's an extra term that involves all high energy matrix elements in the Hamiltonian also. It's not simple to solve for two reasons. First of all, we don't know these high energy matrix elements explicitly. And also, there is a weird dependence on the energy. So it's not a normal Schrödinger equation, but the energy feeds into the Schrödinger equation itself. So this equation, just taken at face value, is not very useful. But actually, it can tell you something about how you should move forward. So you can make a sequence of approximations, for example, by expanding in, if you take, for example, these matrix elements, H high, are very large compared to the energy eigenvalues we're interested in. So if you expand by taking this to be very large, then you can see what the truncation effects are. So you can extract leading and several subleading effects just by looking at this equation. And one thing you can do, which is relates to normal perturbation theory, is that, for example, there's a one-loop order where you can extract beta functions. So you can say how the couplings should change if you want to keep the physics the same by changing the UV cutoff. So this, it looks very much like normal perturbation theory. And there are two take-home messages from doing the exercise. It's very technical, but one thing is that the errors you're getting are power law suppressed with respect to the cutoff. And the most important thing, of course, is what this power is, but that depends typically on the CFT data. So it depends on the scaling dimensions of the perturbations you're working with. It depends on the space-time dimension. And of course, if you're calculating different observables, not energies, then also those observables feed into the error. And there's a second take-home message. That's by adding counter terms, you can actually improve the behavior with respect to the cutoff. So very pragmatically, you can make the error smaller, but you can also, improve, like soften the power of the exponent. So here's a numerical example. If you look just at a massive boson and you add a few subleading corrections, in blue you see, this is the Casimir energy, so you see the difference between the exact and the TCSA value for the Casimir energy here on a log-log scale. And on the x-axis, we're varying the cutoff. So you see that it decreases very slowly, but power law-like if you increase the cutoff. if you add some counter terms, then you see that, well, first of all, numerically the error is much slower. So you can see it here, it's 0.25 or something, here is 0.05, so it's a factor 5 smaller. And you also see that the power by which it decreases is higher. So it has a nicer behavior with respect to the cutoff. And here on the right-hand side, you'd see the same thing, but for massive states. But again, this is something that's very theory dependent. So in this case, we can give some very concrete prescriptions. But in another theory, you'd need to do more work. Here's also the picture you're getting. So visually, you see that the truncation effects, which are very pronounced here, as you make the radius larger than 3, they're much smaller. So here they're around the 5% level. So the behavior is definitely better if you add these counter terms. Okay, because you're worried about the presence of these, for example, these high energy matrix elements that are not known explicitly. One way is by looking at the two-point function. So if you look at the two-point function of an operator, then you can actually extract some, like the one loop correction, by looking at the asymptotics as the two operators in this two-point function collide. I don't know if there's a simple. You could even do it by looking at the partition function, by expanding the partition function in terms of these perturbations, taking the perturbations to be small, and then you can do conformal perturbation theory to find one loop corrections.
So there are not things that are done in the context of the numerical calculation itself, but there's something.
There are some external input. You don't calculate this from the numerics. You really need to think about these counter terms before you do the calculation. So you can think of them as counter terms you're adding to the UV of the theory. And in that case, it's very much like doing a normal, well, it works like any other scheme where you need to add these counter terms. You can also add counter terms after the fact, but in general, you can add all these counter terms in the UV. There's one detail that I didn't talk about before, but the past few slides were about adding counter terms that make the error smaller, that improve the behavior with respect to the cutoff. But also, again, as with many other schemes in quantum field theory, the continuum limit, or the limit where you take the cutoff to infinity, is not always well defined. So sometimes there can be divergences. And one very simple example in TCSA is when the operator you're adding to the theory is almost marginal. So what in that case happens is that the free energy, for example, diverges either at order g squared in perturbation theory. In this case, we know how to resolve this. So this is an effect where the cosmological constant gets a large renormalization. So you can just subtract this from the cosmological constant and you end up with a finite theory. But this can also happen not just to the cosmological constant, but to other operators in the theory. And in that case, you really need case by case to think about about the coefficients multiplying these operators. So this is something that you just need to be careful about. And in what follows, we actually do need to be careful about the situation. So that will be the 5-4 theory. Again, something I hope most of us are familiar with to some extent. In 4 dimensions, it's trivial in the IR, so the low energy physics is free, and in more than 4 dimensions, it's the same story. But in less than 4 dimensions, 5-4 is a relevant operator. And we can ask, well, what does the physics look like as a function of these two parameters, lambda, the 5-4 coupling, and m0, the bare mass of the particle. And we should know that this is a Landau-Ginzburg model for the Ising spin system. So we can think of m0 squared as the temperature of a system of spins if we fix the 5-4 coupling. And there's one symmetry, one global symmetry, that's the Z2 symmetry, again, linking phi and minus phi. So there's some lore based on our intuition about what should happen as a function of these parameters. If we take the bare mass to be very large, that is as if we're working up the Ising model at high temperature, and we expect to be in a Z2 unbroken phase. If we take the bare mass to be very low, then there might be a double well situation where the Z2 symmetry is broken. So the field phi will sit in either of those wells, and this will break Z2 symmetry. And there will, yeah, and there should also be between these two phases some critical point where you're not probing massless gap theories, but you're in a massless critical point, which should agree with the easing model in D dimensions. And it would be very nice if TCSA could actually give evidence for the situation. So we, of course, know this for other means that this works, but it's a good test for TCSA to see if it can deal with these strong coupling phenomena, say, in three dimensions. But actually, three dimensions is a difficult case because of what I said in the previous slide. So there's a logarithmic divergence that occurs if you take the number of space-time dimensions to be three. So you need to, well, this mass term gets a large renormalization. And just because this is an exploratory work, we want to avoid this. So if you want to make this theory fully finite, you can show that you need to work in less than 8/3 or 2.6667 space-time dimensions. So that's one reason why the following plots I'll show you are done in 2.5 dimensions, although that might sound like physically not very interesting situation. But it should not be very, like, the physics should not be very far away from three dimensions. So there are, for example, bootstrap studies that actually have done this analytic continuation. And you see that critical exponents, well, they, first of all, critical exponents can be calculated in for any number of dimensions. And also, the qualitative physics should definitely stay the same. So there's no reason to be afraid of 2.5 dimensions rather than two or three dimensions. Sure.
But then in your paper, you argue that theory is actually non-unitarian.
Yes.
So can you comment on that?
Can I comment on that at the end of my talk?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so this, it just because it's easier conceptually, you can set the bare mass to 1, so this will become a reference scale, and the 5/4 coupling will become a parameter you can tune. So there are two parameters here now, two that are interesting. So you have the radius, which tells you how far you are from the UV or how close you are to the IR, and there's a 5/4 coupling that tells you how strongly your coupling is. So this is done at a fixed value of R. So the idea is you do the RG flow. So you pick a value of lambda, you do the RG flow to some finite range, 2.5, and then you look at the spectrum. So again, on the y-axis here, you see the spectrum minus the Casimir energy. And on this axis, you see the 5/4 coupling. Well, if the 5/4 coupling is 0, then you're working just in the massive theory. And well, these are the values we already found before. So there's no surprise here. Then you turn on the 5/4 coupling, and somehow you see that the energies go lower and lower and lower. Here, there's kind of a strange crossover region where the massive states have a kink, and one of the states, the one particle state, actually seems to go almost to zero. And here on the right-hand side, if the 5/4 coupling is very large, well, there's a strange phenomenon where all states seem to come in pairs. So I didn't explain before, but the blue dashed lines are Z2 even states, and the red lines are Z2 odd states. So there seems to be a phenomenon where the states are paired.
How many states did you keep
in the, yeah, okay, so again, this just shows, I think, 4 or 5 states in every sector, but in the full theory, we're working with several thousand states.
Is this coming to the fact that there is a Z2 spectrum symmetric vacuum?
Yes, and this is what I will argue.
No, because you called it mysterious, sorry.
Yeah, so it's mysterious at this point, but I hope it will be clear in several slides. Yeah, so to give an idea about the time it takes, well, it depends very much, like the physics doesn't depend strongly on the cutoff because the errors are power law suppressed. So if you change the cutoff by 1 or 2 units, then this picture doesn't change a lot, but the CPU time, of course, does. But these are things that are done on like laptop or desktop systems. And so if you want to make a full plot like this, it can be several hours or even a day in term, depending on the precision you want to get. But it's not numerically, it's not very intensive. OK, so first, let's go to the left-hand side of the plot. So really, the y-axis itself is very simple. We already discussed it before. So let's sit in the middle between this point and this kink area. So I think the plot is made at 0.3. So let's take a slice over here. So we set the 5/4 coupling to this special value. And then we do the RG flow. So here, the radius is small. We're close to the UV. So we're just probing the free theory. If we make the radius larger, then the couplings become large, and we're in some massive phase. How do you see it's a massive phase? Just like with the massive boson, see that the spectrum asymptotes to a constant value, so it must be massive physics. You can also say that it's not very far away from perturbation theory in one sense, that this is a Z2-odd one particle state, and you see that here there's a Z2-even state that had almost twice the mass of one state of the one particle state, so it gives the idea that this is a two-particle state that looks very much like a free theory, but it's not really a free theory. So you see that this point would correspond to having bare mass equal to one, so the mass of this one particle state is significantly lower than what you'd have in a free massive theory. So from the point of view of this theory, it's still moderately or strongly coupled. It's dressed by this Phi-Forf interaction. There's some other things. Well, if you're afraid, then you could say that these look like level crossings. And in a generic interacting field theory, we don't want to have level crossings. But in fact, if you zoom very closely to this point, you see that the level crossings are avoided. So that's not a problem either. Otherwise, it's difficult to say something quantitative about this plot, simply because, well, first of all, this calculation is done in 2.5 dimensions, and very few people are interested in 2.5 dimensional physics. But even if you did this in three dimensions, then, for example, the lattice doesn't give a lot of material to compare with. So in a way, this is a prediction about a strongly coupled Phi-Forf theory physics. But at this point, it's difficult to compare it to anything. But in the future, if somebody has a different scheme, then they could definitely compare to these results.
So what is improved by counter terms?
So this is improved by these counter terms that are, well, yeah, so in the IR here, they're important to add. So if you don't add these counter terms, then the cutoff behavior is definitely worse.
And so you computed these counter terms also loop diagrams?
In conformal perturbation.
Including lambda before?
Yeah. So the most important renormalization effect here comes from the bare mass that gets a contribution from the Phi-Forf interaction. That's the most important counter term you need to add. Okay, so that was this part of the diagram. Now let's go to the strongly coupled region, so where Phi-Forf becomes very important. Again, this is a massive theory because, okay, we play the same game. So on the y-axis, you have the energy spectrum. On the x-axis, there's the radius. And again, if the radius gets large, then the spectrum almost asymptotes up to truncation effects. And okay, there is this strange pairing between Z2-even and Z2-odd states. So how can this be brought into alignment with the spontaneous symmetry breaking picture? That's not very difficult. So let's start from the double well. That would be a situation of spontaneous symmetry breaking. In infinite volume, you just quantize around either of those wells, and you're completely insensitive to what happens in the other well. But here we're working in finite volume, so this is at radius 2 or 2.5. So there can definitely be tunneling between those two wells. And it is important to notice that this tunneling is strongly suppressed, as we all know, so it's exponentially small with respect to the volume, but still there's a slight degeneracy. So what happens is that every state, so here, for example, there's the ground state, which is really at zero, and there's kind of a Z2-odd almost vacuum close by. The ground state is the Z2-even one, is the sum of those two vacua, and the fake ground state just on top is a difference between the two vacua. And for all other states, you see the same phenomenon. So the one particle state in this theory has this effect, the two particle, et cetera. And at high enough in the spectrum, then the truncation effects simply become important. So you can no longer clearly distinguish those pairs of states.
Could you have a state with your domain wall? Are all states going to be paired up, or is it possible to have a state where you have a domain wall between each of them somehow nothing doubled up? I'm not sure.
That's a difficult question. I'm not sure if you're sensitive here to
that's a state you cannot resolve there or not. Presumably, yes. I would say yes. Just have to look for it.
Yeah, they're massive states. Okay, I need to think a bit more about this question, but it's definitely interesting to, it would be very interesting to probe this using TCSA.
Dotted lines is twisting.
This one we need it. Yeah, it's tantalizing.
It's very difficult to match this quantitatively to any other theory.
In these states?
Yeah, you'd want to calculate just the VAB of phi, for example.
Yes.
It should be possible, but
there's a more general program that I haven't thought much about, but that's calculating correlation functions using TCSA. So in principle, it's possible because you just require the conformal algebra and knowledge of the Hamiltonian. So the ingredients are both there, but you need to think a bit about how you set it up in practice. But I'm quite convinced that it can be done, and especially VEVs should be the easiest observable to do in this regard. It's difficult to say something quantitatively about the spectrum, but there's a nice qualitative agreement with something our lattice friends found a long time ago. So if you look at the one particle state in the second excitation, and you see that the second excitation is lower than twice the one particle state. So this tells you that there's a bound state in the spectrum. And although on the lattice this has not been simulated in 2.5 dimensions, but in 3 dimensions, we still find the same qualitative agreement. So, it's at least something, but again, it's a prediction for the future. And now let's go to the most interesting region. So this crossover regime between the Z2 unbroken and the Z2 broken phases. And here, how do you start analyzing this? Well, you can just look at the lowest excitation from the Z2 unbroken phase, so the one particle state, which is the mass gap of the theory. And it gets lower and lower and lower as you increase the phi-fourth coupling. And at some point, it seems to vanish. So here you get a blow up of this diagram. So there are two lines coming from TCSA. One is at radius 2.5, that's the dashed line. One is at radius 3, that's the solid line. So this is just to give a comparison that it doesn't strongly rely on picking 2.5 as the radius, but it's more generic. Then you can simply, suppose that this were a critical point, then the theory of critical phenomena tells us how the mass gap should approach this critical point. So it should go to if you change lambda and tune it to some critical value lambda star, then it should go like a power law with some exponent u that can be calculated through other means. So here you do a fit of the mass gap as you approach some value. So it depends on these two parameters, lambda star you don't know and u. And you find that nu is equal roughly between, it's equal to 0.65, 0.8, up to error bars. Because as you see, the error bars are quite large on this measurement. Then you can compare to other methods, say the conformal bootstrap, and they give a very precise value for this exponent nu, 0.755. So the values TCSA gives are definitely consistent with what more precise methods give, but sorry, I see your question.
The 3D value?
0.67.
Or no, it's rising in slabs.
It's 1 over d minus the dimension of epsilon. So it's 0.4, I think, for this exponent u. There was another?
No, it's about 0.5. Right? 0.5 is the...
For the value of the exponent. But this is not a critical exponent itself. This is a derived exponent. This nu is not it's not the operator dimension itself. It's like 1 over...
It's about
0.5. Oh, yes, it should be. Yeah, it's about 0.5. Yeah.
0.5 or something.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So is this your best estimate for this exponent? Or
I will give another estimate for critical exponents.
But just better than this?
No, I think this is cleaner. So this would be the best estimate for this exponent. There are two sources of errors here. So one, of course, is that you're not really in the Ising model itself. You're still a finite distance away from the UV, but you're not in the infinite volume limit. So if you really want to be sitting square on the nose of the easing model, you need to take the radius larger and larger, but this is something that just practically cannot be done. And also there are some errors due to this finite cutoff. So here we're already renormalizing the Hamiltonian. We're working with an improved action to make these errors smaller, but still there are some errors. So one way to get these errors down would just be not to make the numerics more expensive, but just by adding some more counter terms. So by thinking more about like going to higher loops in 5-4 theory, if you wish, by adding these counter terms. So you can also approach this from a different way. So this tells you how you should pick the 5-4th coupling in order to make the theory critical. So you say there's a coupling lambda star equals 0.55 or something. This is the critical phase. So then you can make a different plot, where you just, in the UV, you set the 5-4th coupling to this value, and then you start the RG flow. And this is supposed to be an RG flow between two CFDs, right? So in the UV, you have the free theory. In the IR, you have the easing model. And in between, there will be some crossover effects. So here, on the y-axis, we're plotting the energy multiplied by the radius, because that's what you need to get the scaling dimensions. The spectrum is given by scaling dimensions divided by the radius. And on the x-axis, we're plotting the radius itself. So what you see is some of these values seem to asymptote. For example, the one particle state, in the theory, if you wish, the lowest excitation, well, it goes to an almost constant value. For the second exponent, which should be epsilon in the easing CFT, it still rises a bit, but still it's almost flat. And if you go higher in the spectrum, like if you look at these states, then they clearly haven't converged yet. So they're not flat lines on this plot. So you cannot expect the values you're getting to be very reliable. But if you look at the prediction of the exponent, for example, for sigma compared to its analytic value, then you see that the two are quite consistent. So there's a large error bar. These error bars are conservative, so they're coming from both finite radius and truncation effects. But you see that the predictions you're getting are consistent with bootstrap calculations. So, and there is still space for improvement. But again, this is not a precision method like come from a bootstrap where you would really get those exponents with six digits on the nose if you make the effort. So, sure.
Can you oscillate to approach the value, or can you have an oscillation term in the power?
If there's a kind of a no-go theorem, that it should be.
Let's see. Is it consistent with what we're seeing? It is consistent with what we're seeing.
I don't see a concrete reason why you could not oscillate. But it's difficult. I mean, this is non-perturbative. So even if you could prove something like this to one or two orders in perturbation theory, then you would still need to do more work to show that it's true. But it's an interesting question. I mean, I don't know. If anybody has ever thought of this. Okay, so that's roughly the numerical part I want to discuss today. So this was the practical walkthrough of TCSA in D dimensions. Now there's like one remaining issue that I think needs some attention. So first of all, very naively, we didn't work in an orthonormal basis. So we were working in some arbitrary basis of states that was just convenient for doing the calculation. But this wasn't even organized in representations of the conformal group. So we weren't working in terms of primary operators and descendants, but just in linear combinations of primaries and descendants that seemed useful. But as a matter of principle, you might want to actually work in an orthonormal basis or go to a basis that respects the conformal symmetry group. So what you do in that case is you calculate the Gram matrix, so you calculate the matrix of inner products of these states. And if you're working in a unitary theory, then you can just diagonalize this matrix, and this tells you how you can go from your old basis to a nice orthonormal basis. Actually, if you do this exercise, then you find out that you cannot do this exercise, in the sense that some states have zero overlap with the rest of the Hilbert space. And this is something I think that's familiar in physics. It happens more often. And just means that this is a null state. The state chi here would be a null state. And you can just consistently throw it out of the theory. So you just don't take these states into account in the Hilbert space anymore, and what you end up with is a unitary theory. It might be nice to get some intuition of where these states come from. So this is the simplest example in three dimensions. So there's a graphical notation for operator. So this is a state built out of four phis. Every phi gets a red dot. And there are eight derivatives. So a derivative attached to a phi is a line that originates from one of these phis. So in total, there are eight derivatives that are contracted in a certain way indicated by this diagram. It just turns out that there are two ways where you can contract these indices that give precisely the same state. So, but if you're naive, then you would think that these two states are different. So it's just you really need to explicitly do the calculation, and then you see that there's a redundancy in your basis of operators. So I think roughly the reason why this happens is because of trace relations, or you can call this the Cayley-Hamilton theorem. But okay, these relations exist in integer numbers of dimensions. So the Cayley-Hamilton theory doesn't exist in 2.5 or 3.5 dimensions. So there's a question of what happens to these apparent redundancies away from integer dimensions. And in fact, you can calculate the Gram matrix like I did before. And then you find out that there are indeed negative norm states present. So that's a fact of life. You need to accept it. And as a first consequence, this means that the free massless boson in fractional G is a non-unitary theory. That by itself is not very problematic, because we can still do the TCSA calculations. But you might wonder if some other theories, like the Ising model, share this feature. So one way, you can actually test this in TCSA numerically. So what you can do is you turn on the 5/4 coupling, and then you look at the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. So you really take a large number of states into account. You diagonalize the Hamiltonian. And in a unitary theory, of course, all energies are real. But here, if you look at what happens, then you find some imaginary eigenvalues, no, some complex eigenvalues. So this already is a proof by itself that these interacting theories are non-unitary. And it's also, it gives evidence that the Ising model is non-unitary too. There's one caveat in the sense that we're working here at finite distance away from the UV. So we're not like calculating really in the Ising model itself. And again, there's a cutoff. So the procedure is quite complex. And it would be nice to actually prove this for the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, so for the Ising model, but in a perturbative expansion away from four dimensions. And that's work in progress, something we're looking at now. So it seems that even at one loop order, you can show that this must hold true for the Ising model in the epsilon expansion.
That's not enough,
right?
For the
Wilson-Fisher theory, like formally, this is the IR fixed point.
No, I mean, the
it isn't defined for sure, but yeah, but
I mean, if you add other contributions, higher epsilon, then.
No, but order by order, if you can show that something already, I think if you can show that a coefficient, for example, at one loop order is not consistent with unitarity, then it must hold true to all orders in epsilon. Like, if you can show that something cannot be spoiled by higher order contributions,
yeah,
then yeah.
You have to show that.
Yeah, definitely. You could have an uneasy feeling with this result, because we know that the Ising model in 2D and 3D is unitary, so there are even like 100% rigorous mathematical proofs of this, not just field theory proofs. But there is no inconsistency. Well, and physically what happens is that these negative norm states, once you go to an integer number of dimensions, then they simply decouple. So they don't contribute to observables. They're no longer part of the Hilbert space, so they're fictitious states in the theory. There's a final remark in the sense that all the violation of unitarity we're seeing are very small. So they happen high up in the spectrum with operators of scaling dimension 15 or even 25. And normally you're interested in low energy physics, so these states don't contribute that much. And it seems very difficult actually to measure these small violations of unitarity through other means. So there have been two other recent analysis of physics at fractional D. One is a conformal bootstrap paper, and one is a paper that discusses the F theorem in any number of dimensions, and none of them find anything that's inconsistent with unitarity. But for example, this Bootstrap paper assumes unitarity from the start. So if you know that theories in fractional D are non-unitary, then you need to have a more precise argument of why these Bootstrap calculations give consistent results. And I think here there's some nice work that still can be done in showing, like making precise how these violations of unitarity are small and why there's no inconsistency with other field theory calculations. Sure.
Do you have examples of theories in fractional dimensions which are unitary? For example, if you take like a free fermion CFT and continue it to...
Well, for free boson, the analytic continuation is quite unambiguous in the sense that you only require very few facts by the theory to define like the analytic continuation. But for a free fermion already, you need to really define the scheme. So you say you need to work in dimensional reduction. It's less clear if it's really if your analytic continuation is universal. But yeah, I'm not sure. Well, it seems to be a more generic phenomenon, but I don't know if there's like a theorem that tells you that every fractional dimensional theory should be non-unitary. Might very well be true that there are unitary, special unitary theories in fractional D. Okay, so I think it's almost time to wrap up.
Is there any symmetry in those dimensional
eigenvalues? Yeah, they come in pairs, for example.
I mean, does the TCSA respect?
Yeah, I think TCSA respects PP symmetries.
Yeah, then we're good.
Okay. So, I gave an introduction to this idea of TCSA that has a long backstory. So it's a method for doing non-perturbative calculations in quantum field theory, and it's really non-perturbative in the sense that you're not doing loop calculation, you're doing an honest first principles calculation in field theory at strong coupling. And there are truncation effects, of course, so you add a cutoff to the game, but it is a first principles calculation. It has a backstory in the sense that it has passed quite stringent tests in two dimensions before, and today, or I've shown a few examples where it also has passed strong quantitative tests in three dimensions or in 2.5 dimensions. So the nicest results, of course, were obtained in the case of this massive boson where you could really get 1% accuracy or better compared to exact results. But also for a physically more interesting theory, in this case, the 5-4 theory or the Landau-Ginzburg model, you can reproduce using this theory spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is, of course, a non-perturbative effect. And you can get even precision results. Well, you cannot get results that have the same accuracy as conformal bootstrap or other methods, but you can definitely get critical exponents and the approach to criticality in a way that's completely consistent with these precision results. And I think we've also, well, there was a small amount of work before considering these renormalizations, so thinking about how you should improve your Hamiltonian to reduce the truncation effects, and I've also discussed briefly how this can be done. But there's more work for the future. So the first thing that would be interesting to do is not to work in a scalar field theory, but to work in a fermionic theory. So there are many theories that just involve fermions in low dimensions that are interesting, like the Gross-Neveu model. And it seems like there's a lot to explore. So this would be pretty analogous to the things I've shown today, except for the fact that you need to think more about the representation theory of the fermions to get the same results. Also, this idea of adding counter terms to improve the accuracy is still at an exploratory phase. So I think that there can be more that needs to be done systematically. And one thing, of course, the first thing you'd want to do is to study 5-4 theory honestly in three dimensions and not in 2.5 dimensions. So there's a very clear sequence of steps that needs to be done for this to become true. And there are even some very simple theories like a scalar in 5 or 6 dimensions or a Dirac fermion that are very clean playgrounds to study these renormalization effects. if you think about this, it's also tantalizing to get some high precision results for models you can already solve. So for, say, flows between the minimal models or any system in two dimensions you can think of, there are many exact results you can compare to. From a more fundamental perspective, it would be nice to see if this TCSA regulator respects supersymmetry. It seems that it should be the case, but you, of course, need to add not just one state, but to think of the SUSY multiplets that occur in the Hilbert space. And then there are some very nice examples like the 2D superconformal minimal models. There are nice flows between those theories, so the TCSA would be it would be fun to look at those things. But the elephant in the room is, of course, still Yang-Mills theory. So can this work with gauge theories? And more precisely, what's the best strategy? So if you're thinking about gauge theories, even simple ones like QED, then you need to ask yourself, can gauge invariance be kept manifest? So in this case, should you work in a gauge invariant basis? Can you do this calculation with gauge invariant present all along the way? Or do you need to use some BS-tree mechanism to get rid of unphysical states? Okay. So that's clearly the most important problem for the near future. And I hope that next time I'll be here, I have some more to report on that. And in general, I hope that I've convinced at least some of you this TCSA. Well, the results I've shown today are quite simple. They're just based for the scalar field theory, but clearly there's some strongly coupled physics that can be explored using this method, and there seems to be much more potential. So I hope that in a couple of years' time, we've learned much more about quantum field theory using methods like TCSA. And I'm sure that we can learn many things. Okay, thanks.
So numerically, how heavy would it be to try like the O2?
Numerically, these things are all same order of magnitude. So the thing that takes more time is actually brain power, in the sense that if you want to, you need to just think about the matrix elements and the setup changes a bit. So the Hilbert space, if you have a global symmetry, then it splits into different sectors. So you just need to be very careful about the different states you're having. But numerically, it's the same complexity.
Continuous symmetry wouldn't add much complexity numerically.
No, you can, for example, restrict yourself to a scale of the singlet sector of I don't think it would be a serious problem. But yeah, again, this is something I didn't mention, but of course global symmetries are very natural things you can add to a problem like this. So rather than studying the 5-4 model, study the ON model in D dimensions. It's a very natural thing to do.
How bad are the problems with gauge theories? I mean, if you're going some temporal gauge, so that there is not much.
So the breaking of gauge invariance is...
there's not much gauge freedom left.
Yeah, it seems, okay, that's something that we thought about. The temporal gauge seems like a natural candidate indeed for studying the Yang-Mills theories in three dimensions, for example. So it seems like this could be the way to go, yeah.
I guess we'll be thinking to do things such as Samos theories. But
you mean Chern-Simons coupled to matter.
Yes. I guess you can, I mean, because this is not intuitive, you can have the Chern-Simons interaction.
Yes.
There.
Yeah, but Chern-Simons by itself, it wouldn't be a good candidate for this.
No, I mean, of course.
So I think it's possible that it would be more difficult in terms of setup than just something like QED, which is non-topological and has very simple degrees of freedom. But there's no a priori reason why this couldn't work with topological degrees like Chern-Simons.
No more questions, thank you.